history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And the perspective we gain when we do that is so, so valuable. We're educated, we're entertained, and often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Recently, we aired a program focusing on the 75th anniversary of the concentration camps throughout Europe, and we included an excerpt from Alex Kershaw, who has become as prolific and proficient as anyone capturing the micro and macro stories of World War II in print. I promise that you'd be hearing more from this New York Times best-selling author in the future, and with the 76th anniversary of D-Day coming up, I couldn't think of a better time. I think you're really going to enjoy hearing Alex's passion and his perspective. And speaking of D-Day, if you haven't read Alex Kershaw's book, The First Wave, which came out last year, now is the perfect time. It's newly out in paperback. That's The First Wave, The D-Day Warriors Who Led the Way to Victory in World War II. But that's just the latest in a string of World War II themed works, and we're going to hear about what he's working on now and when we can expect that. But as I welcome Alex in, I want to start with a really basic question that sometimes I ask World War II veterans, but one that I think a lot of young people ask today and will probably consider even more in the future. So Alex, why does World War II still matter? Why should we take the time to learn about it now?
I just think that, you know, we can take an enormous amount of inspiration, and we often take for granted our freedom. And, you know, that's not a cliche, because an enormous amount of people in this massive global conflict lost their lives, civilians far more than combatants, and that we should never forget what they were fighting for. Now, the irony about World War II is that we needed the Soviets, the Bolsheviks and the communists to defeat fascism. Certainly, that's the case in Europe. But we also had to defeat militant fascism and very, very violent and aggressive dictatorial regime in the Pacific, the Japanese, and then obviously Hitler. So this was a global conflict that America played a very important role in. But we shouldn't forget it's a global conflict. And the people that benefited most from the victory in that conflict were Western Europeans and anybody that had been oppressed by the Japanese, and obviously Americans, because democracy could continue. Our way of life could continue. America certainly emerged as a massive superpower after World War II. So I think it's very, we have to remember that the world that we live in today was born out of, was forged out of that global conflict. And we should never forget the sacrifices of the soldiers, men and women that fought in it. And while they're alive, and there's not many left, you know, we should appreciate them and commemorate them and say thank you whenever we can, because it gave an awful lot.
And it really does affect every one of us. And I don't know about you, but sometimes I run into people who they haven't connected with this part of our history, or they don't think it matters, or they don't think there's a connection to their personal life, their personal experience. Is this something that's always been with you, this awareness that something significant happened that affected your life even before you were born? Or was there a moment for you where that kind of clicked in, where it really struck you that, hey, this is something that I need to investigate a little further?
Well, you know, you can tell I'm a Limey. I came to the U.S. in 94 when I was 28 years old. So I've kind of spent almost half my life in the U.S. and then half my life in Europe. So, you know, my grandfather, my mom's dad, died of fatal wounds after a Malta convoy run in 1942. Both my grandfathers served in World War II. One was in the RAF, but the one that died was aboard a couple of very famous, very distinguished British naval destroyers in World War II. And my mum never knew her father. And, you know, my mum's like in her late 70s, and she spent her whole life wondering what it would have been like to have been held by her real father and to have had a father in her life. So, you know, I'm her son, so I grew up in the shadow of her loss too. And us Brits, we we're so immersed in the story of World War II. I think it's something that you know, every British person, certainly when I was growing up, was very much aware of. I remember in the 1970s, for example, my dad driving me and my two sisters from where we lived in the middle of England. We were going to go to France camping, and we drove around the east end of London early in the morning to try and get to the ferry to cross the English Channel. And I remember looking out at this crappy old Ford Cortina station wagon, and I was in the east end of London over 30 years after World War II, and there was like bomb wreckage everywhere. There were craters. The east end of London had not been rebuilt even 30 years later because of the severity of the bombing and the Blitz. So, you know, it was something that was really, I think it's very important today too. Certainly if you look at, for example, the way that the British are getting through this crisis with the virus today, probably the two people that are most inspirational to the English people today, the British, obviously, too. There's a 100-year-old captain who's just been promoted, who's raised over, I think, $40 million for the National Health Service, the health service in Britain. And then there's, and he's 100 years old, so it's a World War II veteran who's like the star, inspirational figure right now. And then there's another centenarian, a 103-year-old Vera Lynn, who's very iconic. She sang probably the most popular and most moving songs of World War II, White Cliffs of Dover, and then right now she has a really big hit with We'll Meet Again. That was a song that so many people who fought in World War II who are still alive will never forget. So my point is that in Britain, it's a 103-year-old woman and a 100-year-old guy who are still the inspirational figures, are the most inspirational figures for millions of people going through this awful crisis. So, you know, that just shows you how powerful the narrative of World War II and what happened then is still in Britain. You know, we talk about Churchill. It's a foundational story for modern Britain. And I think it should be in America. I think the difference is that hardly any civilians were killed in World War II in the U.S. So for Americans, there was a lot of rationing. They had to work very, very hard. Women were empowered. They replaced men in the workplace. But the war was fought 3,500 miles away in one direction across the Atlantic in Europe, and then even further away in the Pacific. It was a very distant war. It was a war that was not truly understood by the average American civilian because they weren't impacted by it, apart from when, you know, they had to work harder, there was certain rationing, and then the major impact would have been the fact that their loved ones were away, that, you know, there were millions of Americans serving abroad, and that obviously many of them were killed, hundreds of thousands wounded, and we don't know how many psychologically affected for the rest of their lives. But there wasn't the devastation of London and the Blitz. There wasn't the utter devastation that most of Europe suffered. I mean, Europe was a ruin 75 years ago today. It was astonishing. The amount of Americans in senior positions that when they toured the battlefields in Europe, Eisenhower, for example, 75 years ago in May 1945, was utterly astonished by the level of devastation in Eastern Europe and Germany. It was a complete ruin. So I think that is something that is missing from the American experience, and one that is very, very much still the memory of the destruction, the memory of the civilian suffering. At least 18 million European civilians were dead at the end of World War II. That's an awful lot of loss and suffering and tragedy and darkness. And it's just a very, very, very powerful experience still today for all Europeans.
Well, and so many of the American veterans witnessed that and then came back to this country
absolutely.
And had that perspective that people here did not have. And I think your books bring that perspective to so many people who didn't live through that time in history. And one of the things I love about your writing, and also in your social media presence, I've really enjoyed watching you reconnect with book subjects and you celebrate these veterans. And there's so much of a genuine reverence, not a sensationalism, not a false hero worship, but a genuine respect and admiration for the things these people did. And I'm just curious how you zero in on the people you decide to write about. How does that process work for you? Where did that come from? Because I know you didn't set out when you were a kid, say, hey, I'm going to write all these books about World War II and guys most people have never heard of before.
Well, you know, it was kind of a slow process for me because I started off after college. I started working as a journalist. And I remember pretty early on when I was about 24, 25, I was very lucky because I got to interview some people who'd lived through the occupation of the Channel Islands. And that's the only part of Britain that was occupied by the Germans. It's three or four islands off the coast of Normandy that the Germans occupied. So we had Brits, British bobbies taking orders from Nazis. So I went there and interviewed some people that lived through the German occupation. And it was, for me, it was really fascinating to be able to go and sit in someone's kitchen, have a cup of tea and talk about what it was like to actually have been there in World War II. So I was kind of thinking to myself, well, as a journalist or anybody that's interested in the past or even the present to a large extent, is there any better story than World War II? No, there isn't. I mean, it's the greatest story of our time. And however morally complex it becomes when you really think about the civilians that were killed by industrial warfare, it's still a pretty much black and white case of the good guys won. So I was like, it was amazing for me to be able to go and actually interview people who'd been in these incredible battles and turning points. So I think the first time I really got to meet World War II veterans and talk to them and sit down and really start talking to them was when I wrote a biography of Robert Capa, who was the famous Life photographer. He was, his images are absolutely legendary. He's the guy that took all the fantastic shots of Americans on Omaha Beach. He was the best war photographer of all time. But anyway, I started interviewing journalists and people and other veterans that had been around. I wanted to find out if there was anybody alive that had been in any of his great iconic photographs. So that was pretty cool. And then I came across, when I was researching Capa, I walked along Omaha Beach, where over 900 Americans were killed on D-Day. And it's about 5.5 mile walk. And I walked all the way along the beach from where Capa had taken his famous 11 photographs and visited the graveyard. And then I went to one end of the beach, which was the most deadly spot you could find yourself on June the 6th, 1944. That was Dog Green sector of Omaha Beach. That's where I think almost over 90% of one infantry company was slaughtered in the first wave. And I was there and I started talking to, this is back in 1999, 2000. I started talking to a guy who had a blue and a gray patch on his shoulder, and he was from the 29th Division. And he said, oh, look down there. And quite a lot of guys from this little town called Bedford in Virginia were killed there. And I started chatting to him. And anyway, I came back and I came back to the US and I started researching Bedford, Virginia. And I discovered that 19 guys from a community of around about 3,000 had actually been killed in this one stretch of Omaha Beach in the first wave, and that was the highest per capita loss of any American community on Allied community too on D-Day. And I thought to myself, well, this is an enormous story of heroism and sacrifice, but what would it be to actually tell the story of these guys, but also to tell the story of their community? So I tried to write a book, which became The Bedford Boys, which cuts between the guys and then the families back at home. So you, even after D-Day, I cut back and forth from Europe back to the small rural community in Virginia. And it was, it was fairly successful and I really enjoyed it. It was a very powerful experience to me. And that was, God, that's a long time ago, almost 20 years ago. And I've been trying to find people to talk to ever since. It's been quite a journey, quite an experience.
I don't know about you, and I don't want to put words in your mouth. This has been my experience. And I haven't been doing it quite as long as you. About 15 years I've been interviewing World War II vets. I find that the more I learn about World War II, the more I think I know about World War II, I realize the more I don't know, that the number of potential stories or other side stories you're aware of just continues to grow exponentially the deeper you dive into it. Have you ever felt kind of that overwhelming sense of you could never grasp all of this?
Yeah, well, definitely, yeah. I mean, I'm not much of an expert on the Pacific War, although it fascinates me. It's a global conflict on a huge scale, over 16 million Americans in uniforms. So much happened so quickly, both in a military sense and a scientific sense and a societal sense. So many things changed so very, very, very quickly. Immense steps forward in so many aspects. I mean, 1941 at Pearl Harbor, America, I think by just before Pearl Harbor, or early 1941 anyway, I think that U.S. forces were only a couple of 100,000 strong. Certainly in 1940, before mobilization under Roosevelt, the Congress had limited the size of the U.S. Army to around about, I think it was 175,000 men. There were very strict neutrality laws in the late 1930s passed by Congress yet again to stop Americans from fighting in foreign wars, to keep America out of the Second World War. So we Americans were, the U.S. was, and I say we because I feel like I'm half American now, my wife and son are, but we were totally unprepared for this global conflict. So when the shock of Pearl Harbor comes and we finally have to wake up and realize that we can't stay out of this, that we've been attacked and we've been attacked mercilessly, that we have to mobilize for a global war because Germany declared war on us on the 10th of December, 3 days after Pearl Harbor. So now we've got the Japanese to deal with in the Pacific, and they are relentless and they are brutal and they are very, very efficient, and they've bombed the hell out of us in our backyard. And then we have the Nazis. And now if you look at the Nazis in the Wehrmacht and the Nazis in 1940, this is, 1941, these guys are scary, scary dudes. Europe, all of Europe has fallen in less than 6 or 7 weeks. The Brits had their backsides kicked out of France. No one had been able to stop them. A very, very violent and sophisticated modern form of warfare that they're practicing with Blitzkrieg. I mean, these are scary enemies. We're really up against it. And in 1941, 42, if you'd taken anybody that really knew what was going on in America and certainly in Britain, and you'd said to Churchill and Roosevelt privately, what are the odds on us winning this war? Now, I don't think either Churchill or Roosevelt or anybody that really knew what was going on would have bet the bank on Allied victory.
Not at all. And your books have helped remind us of what was really at stake and how significant and at times improbable some of these unforgettable moments really were. It's time for our first break, but there's much more to come with best-selling World War II author Alex Kershaw. His latest, The First Wave, is now out in paperback, but what can we expect from him next? Find out when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.